Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
That third very deep voice was Cliff Saren, our senior editorial colleague. And Cliff, your job title again, please.
Oh, yeah, me. I'm the managing editor. Open left brackets, technology, close brackets. But a little bit of a biog. Well, whenever I interview someone, they say, well, how long have you been doing this, Cliff? You know, and I say, oh, well, let me see. I started in 1998. It was a good time. It was a good time to be in IT. So I've been doing it a long time. Well, officially, I've never changed what I do, which is very little, but I have changed my job title.
But you do range over all the technologies, it would be fair to say. Welcome back to the podcast, Cliff. So the last time you were on, you were talking about the end of support for Windows 7. And the world's changed a little bit since then.
Worried about bigger things than Windows 7 falling out of support.
if only we could go back to that time. So you've not been on the podcast during lockdown. So we'd like to ask anyone who joins us during lockdown, Cliff, how's it been for you? How's it going? How are your fish?
I could tell you that I'm now a accomplished home cook. I bought a book on cooking and I've been making dinner and lunch.
And
I've just literally, before I joined this, because I thought it's right at my lunchtime, and I do have a proper lunch break at lunchtime. So yesterday was curry, mazamum, and on Saturday Kitchen, a couple of weeks ago, last week, the secret ingredient is peanut butter. And I could never get the peanut butter to melt. And what they did was they put some lemon juice and it broke it apart. And it was liquidy peanut butter, and it worked really well. So I had that for lunch, and it just made it a little bit too spicy.
I'm dead impressed with that. I had a very just pedestrian ham sandwich for my lunch. Yeah, go Cliff.
You should come round. Well, I'll put it in the post.
Well,
for you.
Yeah, that
could be in my bubble.
Yes, that's right. Because now, as single people, which Cliff and I both are, we can enter other people's households.
Mm-hmm. But you have to be invited and they have to let you in. You can't just say, hey, hi guys, got a key, here on it.
Of course. But you've been quite content in lockdown, it seems, Cliff. You've been running.
Well, I've got company. I've got some fish who've all got names. And one of them's, he is a puffer fish. And I used to speak to Caroline once a week on Monday to update her on how Bob the pufferfish has been going. So she said, well, why don't you tell us all about Bob? Well, Bob's a pufferfish. He looks a bit like, if you don't know what pufferfish looks like, he looks a bit like E.T. from the front, but has an elongated sort of fat body. And as I was trying to say earlier before I fumbled all my words, is that he's got a voracious appetite. And when he does eat, his belly gets really big. Along with puffering up, he has a bit of a beer belly. And you can know he's been fed.
So he's greedy.
Oh, definitely. Put your finger in, you probably won't have a finger left.
Well, one of our production staff is called Bob.
Did you name the fish after our colleague, Cliff? Or
it was the first, well, it's a fish that goes, bobs his head up and down. Yep. And when you walk to the tank, he'll literally accelerate to where you are and accelerate back. So he sort of bobs up, because he can't swim very fast, so he sort of bobs up and down getting there. And there's another one, a parrotfish. And I guess what I've called the parrotfish? I've called the parrotfish Polly.
Oh, classic. Boo-boo. Classic.
So during lockdown, hair has been a big thing. Caroline, you've gone a bit radical very recently during lockdown.
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind the times. I think everyone a couple of weeks into lockdown was like, oh, I don't have to go back to the office for a while, so I'm going to like dye my hair sort of a crazy colour. So I'm a little bit behind the times. I did it about 7 weeks into lockdown. So yeah, my hair's now a shocking shade of pink because, well, like I say, I'm not going to be going to the office anytime soon and I don't have to put myself in front of, you know, CIOs or anything like that, conferences for a while. So I just thought, you know what, let's have a few hair experiments in lockdown. Yeah, so I've done hair. I think the next thing people usually do in lockdown is make banana bread. So I'm going to do that in a couple of weeks. But like I said, I feel like I'm playing catch up. You know, when there's nothing else to do and it's so easy to buy, well, hair dye or any other kind of products along those lines from Amazon, it is just like, oh, you know, let's have an experimental pamper session or whatever. So yeah, that's what I've been filling my time with recently.
And the other thing that's been tricky during lockdown is birthdays.
Yeah. Yeah, I had my birthday last week, and also at the time of recording, Cliff is just days away from celebrating his. Yeah. But I was quite fortunate with the timing of mine, because my birthday was on the 7th of June, which was the first Sunday after the government eased up some of the lockdown rules, that you could have a gathering of six people, a maximum of six people, in your back garden.
Yeah.
So I had a socially distanced birthday party. There was four of us in the household already, so some of them had to remain indoors so we could get people in up to a maximum of six. And I come from quite a big family, so it was kind of a bit of a logistical nightmare, stuff like that. But yeah, we had a steady stream of guests within the confines of the lockdown rules over the course of the day. And on the upside, it did turn into quite probably a bit more boozy than I was anticipating, because you have like groups of people entering the garden, leaving the garden, and every time a new person comes, you think, oh, I'll top up your glass, or, oh, I'll have one as well. And then over the course of the day, I was just like, all the guests have gone, and I feel absolutely pretty much off my face. Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, it was a good time, a very good time. Actually, probably one of the best birthdays I've had in a long time. So yeah, I'd recommend it.
So top tips for some of our listeners who will also be having birthdays. And Cliff, your birthday's coming up.
Yes.
Now that you can enter other people's houses, any plans to do that?
I'm going to hold it in a park. Because it's got a cafeteria and it's got public toilets that are open.
Ooh.
And this is important when you're bringing them all these and having a picnic for a birthday.
It is amazing how our expectations have just shifted, isn't it? It's like, yeah, this place has got toilets and open space. Woo, birthday time. Whereas I want to make sure there's these items on the menu, or like, oh, you know, they stock this particular wine. It's like, nah, it's a free-for-all now.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to be doing about finding a social bubble to join in Oxford this weekend. So the big news in Oxford this week is the Roads Must Fall campaign, which has been given fresh impetus. We're recording this on Friday the 12th of June, by the way. So it's a campaign that's been on the go for about 5 years. There's a statue of Cecil Rhodes, who's a 19th century imperialist. I went to Oriel College, Oxford, and there is a statue of Cecil Rhodes that adorns the side of Oriel College, Oxford. It's on the High Street in Oxford. And yeah, that campaign has been given some fresh impetus because, of course, last weekend in Bristol, statue of Edward Colston went into the drink. Colston being a 17th, 18th century slaver, name is a very big presence in Bristol. So very, very dramatic. And of course, the overall context is the Black Lives Matter movement, re-energized, of course, by the murder of George Floyd, an African-American man who was killed by a policeman in Minneapolis. Terrible, terrible kind of thing. But other statues are coming down in the US as well as here, so who knows, maybe this weekend I'll get to see a bit of statue disrupting business going on. And in our own very kind of small world of UK IT, there was a story this week which is a good news story in this respect. So the government's funding 2,500 places on various AI and data science courses. These are kind of conversion courses, so you can come from like a non-science discipline or a discipline outside of computer science. And 1,000 of those places are being targeted at underrepresented groups, which means women, it means people from the BAME communities. One of the things that was in the statement that DCMS released, that's the Department for Digital Media, Culture and Sport, that 4% of all technology workers in the UK are Black or from other minority ethnic communities. I mean, 4%. Mm. That is just dreadful, isn't it? It's it's just such a big issue at the moment. And I mean, we know, don't we, as IT journalists, that when we go to a conference, even in like a liberal city like San Francisco, all the African American people are mostly doing like the security, they're handing out the drinks, and you will almost never see an African American IT professional on stage or put in front of you as a company spokesman. You know, there's an awfully long way to go. So things with that little announcement might get a little bit better in IT post the pandemic, if we can get more, you know, more people into AI and data science who are maybe coming from other backgrounds, including non-science backgrounds. The top line on the podcast, we're going to discuss that. We're going to discuss the likely shape of IT after the COVID pandemic, its role in promoting economic recovery and so on. And Cliff's going to lead on that. I was at COGX this week, which I'll say a little bit more in a bit, which Tony Blair spoke about COVID. So I'm going to talk about that and an interview that I did with Chris Yu, who's the executive director of the technology and public policy team at the Tony Blair Institute. And then Caroline, you're going to raise our spirits with flowers.
Yeah, just it kind of comes full circle back to something we were talking about a few weeks ago on the podcast about how everyone's getting into gardening. And yeah, so there's a kind of a COVID angle, but also a gardening angle. And it's just, it's about sort of the lengths that the organisers of the Chelsea Flower Show have had to go to this year to ensure the show can still go on, even though the actual in-person event was cancelled. So yeah, quite an interesting chat.
It is a very interesting case study indeed. We're going to start with Cliff. You've been writing a slew of stuff about the possible future shape of IT after the pandemic. So what are you seeing in your crystal ball?
Well, I began writing about this stuff way back, I think in January, when the conferences started to get cancelled.
You did.
And it struck me that even at that time, you know, there's IT leaders had a role to play. And we've been seeing that sort of pan out. There was a piece that I wrote about celebrating IT heroes. And I think without the people who have allowed us to connect remotely, you know, this country would be in a far worse place. Imagine, you know, if office workers could not get access to the internet, the virtual private networks that we're all relying on, you know, or the access to Zoom, even, you know, the back office services that we're using, you know, Office 365, all of this stuff is suddenly come to the front. It's suddenly become really important to provide, you know, connectivity and collaboration. And I've been looking at, well, what does it mean for a CIO? We always look at the long-term strategy. You know, it's like IT business alignment. Has IT ever been aligned properly with business? No one ever takes IT seriously. Hell, IT is being taken really seriously now. You know, without technology, where would we be? Where would this country be? So I looked at the role of desktop IT, because desktop IT isn't about providing desktops to end users. That was the definition. That was the definition when IBM kind of invented the PC. It liberated information technology so that people could run their own spreadsheets and eventually write, you know, documents without requiring a secretary to type it out, and, you know, all this sort of stuff that happened in the 70s and 80s. And nowadays, you know, we have wealth of information at our fingertips, and we have desktop productivity tools. But actually, that's not what desktop IT is about. Desktop IT is about providing Zoom calls, providing collaboration, making it really easy for people to use whatever tool they want to do the job, and not really putting blockers in the way to say, well, this is not official. You kind of do need security in place. And I think I've spoken to people about how much security do you put in place. But I can imagine CISOs tearing their now much longer hair out, because we're kind of breaking the rules, or getting around the rules in order to achieve, in order for businesses to remain operational. But fortunately, the risks have to be managed. But I think you can't just lock down everything. And that's sort of one of the things I've been seeing. And if that's one takeaway, I think that business, you know, there's been a conversation with IT in the business. And that has meant that, for instance, in the city, you're not allowed to, the traders aren't allowed to work remotely. It's just, you know, there's FSA regulations, you know, you're not allowed to do that. But without being but that has had to be almost take a step back. How is the city going to trade if everyone is not allowed to get into work? And so you're seeing people and businesses work around, try and overcome the barriers of the lockdown in order to carry on and be operational. I was dialing into a conference last week. It was the MuleSoft event, and I also spoke to the CIO of the Rail Delivery Group. His name's Simon Moorhead. As we all know, the rail networks, or at least the government, has been holding it up, supporting it during the lockdown, at least. And as things start opening up and the government's trying to encourage people to use public transport, you know, we're being told we've got to wear face masks, for instance, as of the 15th of June, right? If you want to use a public transport. There's also what happens in train stations. How do you reduce the number of people milling around waiting for a train to arrive? And the Rail Delivery Group they kind of set standards for rail operators. And they've been looking at all sorts of things. And one of the things that suddenly has come to the front of their conversations is the use of smart ticketing. I mean, think about, why don't we do this already? Well, they have been, but there hasn't been this push to get it done. Why I think that, you know, what we're learning from the pandemic and as we ease the lockdown is that some of the projects that are nice to have are suddenly become really important. You know, digitization, it's a nice to have. It's nice to have all joined up systems and things like that. But if you don't have the joined up systems, you don't gain efficiency. And if we are in a situation where every penny counts, then you need the most amount of efficiency, right? And I think we're going to see a lot more of, you know, IT getting involved in trying to make businesses run as efficiently as possible. Smart ticketing is an example here in the in London, for instance. With if you can achieve that, it means that people don't have to queue up at train stations to get their physical tickets. It also means for them, they've got to integrate all the systems between the different operators, so that one smart ticket will get you from, you know, London to Glasgow, for instance. The other thing that came out of the MuleSoft conference, and this does apply very much internally to IT, and I touched on it with the CISO that I was mentioning earlier about security, but for the whole of IT, we in IT cannot be seen as the only people who have access to the data and provide control and access to that data. Corporate data, I'm talking about. You know, as I mentioned, we've had things like Word and Excel, and Excel is actually is the most widely used business reporting tool, right? Because it's so easy for people to create little spreadsheets and graphs and charts out of that. It might not be the most efficient tool, but it's out there, and everyone has it because everyone, you know, majority of people have, you know, Microsoft Office. And if you don't, there's free software that can do the same thing. There are reporting tools out there. Now, if people have access to data, they don't need to go to IT. So what IT needs is a governance structure to enable people to do their jobs without having to raise a support ticket every time they want access to a new data set.
So that's more, that's the kind of the self-service aspect of it. Interesting. So this idea, it's like the pandemic has been like a catalyst, then you're saying, for some of these digital transformation projects and so on. And I have heard quite a few people say, and actually Tony Blair said that this week at COGX, that there's been more change in the past 10 weeks than the past 10 years. It's quite a common thing to hear, and it's clearly an exaggeration. But nevertheless, there is something to it, isn't there? And also just the speed with which projects have been carried out. That's been a kind of remarkable phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I did a case study it's basically Lloyd's Insurance. And in the insurance sector they want to digitize, but there's so much going on that it takes a long, long time to do stuff. But once the city closed down, they had to force people to work from home, and they had to set up processes to make sure that people worked from home.
Yeah.
It would have been a nice to have feature that maybe the last thing on your list, but now it was top priority. And I think we were also seeing, and I know there was a couple of conferences on low code. There's no reason that everyone, you need a software developer to write software. You know, Microsoft's been doing this with stuff like Visual Basic for Applications, which is the scripting language that used to be in Excel, for instance. But there are more tools now, and it's much, much easier. You can literally, with a few clicks of a mouse, you can create an application. And that application needs access to data. This is why it's important that IT relinquish some of the control, still keep the governance, but relinquish the absolute control over I write all the application, because, you know, we know best.
So I wonder, Cliff and Caroline, I'm sure you've got some thoughts about this too. I mean, from the point of view of our readers, if we're thinking about this kind of mass remote working that we've all been doing, to what extent are our guys going to be thinking about how do we institutionalize that for the future? How do we really, because it's one thing to have people working remotely in an emergency mode, but it's another to have them working remotely over a much longer period of time. Or to what extent do they have to think about, actually, a lot of people want to go back and will want to go back to seeing their friends and colleagues and all the rest of it. I mean, what, got any thoughts about the likely longevity of this sort of way of working? I mean, do we miss each other as workers?
No, yeah, obviously you do miss your colleagues and everything. But another question, I don't know, I'm not sure I'm going to answer the question. I'll probably just pile another question on top of that as well. You do wonder if the economics of suddenly having everyone working from home and being able to work from home will sort of maybe make sort of business leaders rethink whether or not, oh, do we actually need the expense of having sort of inner city offices? Or if we do have an inner city office, do we need to make them so big and take up so much floor space if we can have a proportion of the workforce working from home comfortably each day of the week? So I don't know. It might not be like a mass sort of everyone's going to work from home anymore, because it doesn't suit every personality type to do that. Yeah. But, you know, will it mean that, as much as you hear horror stories about it, will hot desking become more of a kind of, oh, well, we could do this and we can downsize the amount of office space we need because, you know, maybe a proportion of other people with personality types who prefer to be at the office, you know, favour that way of working. You do wonder if, you know, when things do start to return to normal, whatever that looks like, if, you know, how many of the changes we've seen now will be long lasting and which ones people are just, you know, hankering at the just, oh, I can't wait to get back to the office, or I can't wait to sort of do all my meetings in person, no more virtual meetings and stuff like that, no more virtual podcast recordings, all that kind of stuff. It will be behavioural, a lot of it, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
I mean, purely anecdotally, you know, you must have heard it, that people are saying, oh, I can hear the birds sing. People are saying, oh, isn't it so nice that we've got fresh air? And I was at dialed into a conference a few days ago from Bentley Systems. It was all about how city planners need to think about what a new normal will be like. That's being a new normal, what's it mean, whatever. But even if a small proportion of people choose flexible working, that will have a massive impact on rush hour in every city that relies on, you know, people moving to and from at certain periods of time. But I mean, it's all like, you know, can you imagine the rush hour trains being rush hour extended over 8 hours because we've got flexible working times? I mean, that's, and what happens if the majority of people choose to work remotely? What happens to the business districts, you know, all the shops and support services around those business districts? So they can't be sustained any longer if there's not thousands upon thousands of people going out at lunchtime to have a coffee or whatever. It's very interesting, and the managed offices and things like that. I've spoken to people who said it doesn't make sense to have these huge glass buildings. But then, what happens to those glass buildings? I mean, how do you, you know, reuse the space? And what happens to people who really do want to be in the office?
And I suppose the truth of the matter is we just don't know. So I did an interview this week. This is on the back of CogX, with a lady called Margaret Heffernan, who, Cliff, I know you've interviewed a few times too. Very interesting, ex-CEO, a mentor to CEOs, and a business author. And I was discussing this whole remote working thing with her, and she said that some of her clients and people in her network hate it and we're talking about really senior business people here, like CEOs, they hate this remote working thing because they can't get a feel for their business. It's okay in the short term, but in the longer term, that's going to be tricky. And she mentioned one woman, an investment banker, who said that she really misses the people she dislikes, because, you know, you define yourself in amongst your colleagues, not necessarily the people you like, but the people you dislike as well. But her more, kind of more serious point there, I know she's made this point to you, Cliff, because you have written about it, is that we tend to underestimate the social nature of companies, and that when a company or when a group of people get into a very dire situation of existential risk, that the groups and the companies that pull out of that are where the friendship networks are strong, because basically what you're doing there, you know, if you're up against the wall, is that you are fighting alongside your colleagues and your friends. Remote working, I think it's fine for the likes of us because we know each other anyway and we've known each other for quite a long period of time. But if you've got new people coming in, you know, and sustaining those relationships over time with remote working, she was suggesting is going to be a bit tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, what is it? What is the definition of a company? It's a collective noun that defines a group of people who happen to be working together quite efficiently and well, I would argue. For a common goal, right? You know, if everyone in the company understands the goals and the CEO's message can be distributed and disseminated to everyone and they can follow those guidelines, you know, there shouldn't be any reason why wherever you work, you know, you are part of that company and that part of that group. I think what she was talking about is that, yes, in times of incredible, and we've seen this things with the NHS, for instance, you know, when things are really, really bad, people who know each other tend to pull together very, very well. But that's a cultural thing. And maybe what will come out of the pandemic is that we're going to have to extend the network of people we call upon and trust, because, you know, there may be someone who's, you know, the best brains in the company who happens to be constantly on the end of a telephone or, you know, remote working because they cannot physically get into the office anymore. It just may become the norm. But some people will be in the office, obviously. You know, there's going to be a need for that.
I thought you wrote a brilliant little piece, Cliff, about agile software development and how, like, the business IT divide thing gets kind of broken down when you have people working together and face-to-face and you're getting the requirements from conversation, right?
You do. Yeah. I mean, you know, one thing, we've seen this ourselves. I mean, I remember in the previous, you know, when we worked in Sutton, a long time ago, we were on the same floor as the IT people. And whenever there was a support call, you knew that you could literally walk over to their desk and they would walk over to your desk. And that's just a simple thing. But I can imagine when you know someone in, you know, on the technology desk, you can literally go, you know, you get things done a lot quicker and they understand things a lot quicker. As an IT person, how you get to understand the inefficiencies in an application. It's all very well for a manager to say, yes, we click on this button, then this button, then this button, and this happens. But the people who are operating those IT systems, the end users of those systems, say, well, yeah, you know, that's never how I use it. I've got like six windows open. I cut and paste from here into this application. And what tends to happen when business analysts are looking at, well, is this really working? They look at how the real end users are using the applications. Ideally, they're looking at, well, look at all the inefficiencies. This is they'll have the spec of what has to be done and say, well, actually, there's another process here that someone's forgotten about because the data's not captured anywhere, or a free-form text, and, you know, someone's cut and pasting from an email because that's the only way to get the information in. That won't happen if you cannot see the person's screen constantly, and, you know, it's about engaging with those end users. So yes, it was an interesting conversation about software development, because obviously software development is very used to working remotely. You know, we have offshore software development, but there's always the handover, the user acceptance testing. It's defined in you get delivered this thing. This is waterfall. I don't know how it works in Agile. In waterfall, you deliver the piece of software after it's been developed somewhere, and then comes back to you, and then you accept it or whatever. You go through the testing. I don't know. In this new world where things are, you know, have to evolve and move a lot more quickly, that's got to be a lot more difficult if you're not face to face with people.
I think that was a drift of the kind of thing that Margaret was saying, and I said that she was speaking at CogX, Cognition X, which is in its third year now. It started off as a very AI-focused conference, but it's a lot broader now. Tabitha Goldstaub and Charlie Muirhead, apologies to Tabitha if I mispronounced their surname there. But it was a virtual event, very impressive. I mean, there were certainly a lot of speakers, about 30,000 plus attendees over a kind of 3-day video conference call. One of the speakers was Tony Blair, which they were very excited about. And there's no denying that he is box office, Tony. Very good communicator. He was talking about COVID and what it's done, and in the name of his own institute, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. He's being interviewed by Jacqueline de Rocas, who's president of Tech UK, therefore, you know, in our world. And he said interesting things. One of the things he said was the international collaboration on COVID has been among governments has been very poor, certainly not up to the mark. He put a big emphasis on the role of technology, which you could say is a bit surprising, because he's not really associated with, I mean, as a prime minister, he wasn't really associated with being au fait with technology. I think famously, he didn't actually have a mobile phone until he left office, which is a way of curtailing communication with him, as opposed to by him. But he's putting a big emphasis, his institute and in the talk, on the role of tech in general for government, but and specifically for this disease. Towards the end, he kind of adverted to a kind of more practical element of the possible solution, which is to have a sort of almost like digital passports. So your disease status would be encapsulated in a QR code on your mobile phone, and that would give you certain kind of accesses. And if if you don't have the right access for a certain situation, then you wouldn't get that access. It sounded to me a bit like ID Cards Revisited, which went really well originally. There's a big Tony Blair kind of project of New Labour back in the day. So I did a wee interview with, a follow-up interview with a chap called Chris Yu, very nice man, executive director, as I said earlier, for the technology and public policy team at the Tony Blair Institute, just to kind of get a bit more flesh on the bone, a bit more context. So he said, first of all, he just kind of put the context of the Institute, which is to kind of try and bring together what Tony would call change makers, which in terms of tech would be tech entrepreneurs, I guess, and tech companies. On the one hand, and people who do policy stuff in government globally, on the other. Chris said a couple of times that all the technology that we need to kind of exit from this and move forward and reflate the economy and get beyond the recession that almost certainly is going to come, the technology is all there. It's not like theoretical technology, but it's implementing it at scale and the governance around it. So like if you have those digital passports, who gets to see it? Who can ask to see it? Is it just a police officer and that's problematic? Yeah. Or is it a security guy at a nightclub or whatever? Let me see your QR code for COVID. So it's all those kind of all those kind of things. And I came back and asked them about the international collaboration piece, like, okay, so what would make that better? And, you know, what's the issue here? He said a number of things, but he said something that Caroline, you and I, and Joe talked about when we talked about the contact tracing app, which is that, you know, these problems are the same. You know, we're all in the same boat all over the world. So it seems crazy to kind of duplicate technological solutions when, you know, you could just, you know, have a few that would actually work. But yeah, and another kind of thing that we touched on, myself and Chris, was, you know, what is going to happen afterwards, to the extent that who will want to go back to the way things were before? I mean, the example that he gave to me was of consulting his family doctor over a video conference, like, I don't know whether it was a Zoom call or whether it was something else, but whether people will now go back to phoning up for a GP appointment and, you know, being there in person and things like that. And also just with internet shopping, who will actually want to go back to spending a lot of time in shops? And nobody knows. It was a virtual event, COGEX. Caroline, you've just had published on the website, or it should be up soon, your story about the...
The Chelsea Flower Show. Now we've actually gone through today's podcast discussion. There's a few different themes in it that we've all touched on that actually this makes maybe the case study a little bit more timely. Background to the story was, you know, obviously we started today's podcast talking all about our lockdown activities, and avid listeners to the show, hello mum, will know that I've got into gardening in quite a big way during the pandemic, particularly with regard to sort of trying to grow my own vegetables and stuff like that. And some of those efforts have been far more successful than others. But as you can probably guess, I'm far from alone in wanting to do that at the moment. You know, you only have to look at how excited people got a few weeks ago when the government announced that garden centres were going to open again, and everyone's like, oh my god, garden centres. But yeah, so this trend, everyone getting into gardening, is great news for the Royal Horticultural Society, which is a charity which is primarily focused on getting more people in the UK into gardening. And one way they do that every year is through the events that they hold. And the big flagship one every year is the Chelsea Flower Show, which typically runs across 5 days in May within a specially created showground within the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. And it's like an event. People go along to it, and the exhibitors showcase and like the latest thinking in garden design, as well as sort of new plant species or any other sort of, you know, wondrous creations they've been working on. It is, like I say, to inspire people to think, oh, go, you know, leave the event, think, okay, I could do something similar myself at home. It's a really important event each year for the work the society does. And preparations for this year's event were thrown into turmoil about 8 weeks before the show was about to go ahead, because the UK government announced that we were all going to go into lockdown to curb the spread of the coronavirus. And that meant this show, which can be years in the making for some of the people, some of the exhibitors, some of the species they're working on, was just flat out cancelled, like a lot of mass gatherings and large events at the moment. For understandable reasons, it couldn't go ahead. But it was a decision that, you know, left a lot of people disappointed. You know, the exhibitors, the people who had tickets to attend, and also the society itself, you know, at a time, like I say, what they want to achieve is also like naturally happening within, like, across the UK. People are getting into gardening. You kind of think an event like this could just pull in even more people, and obviously it all had to be cancelled. But basically they decided that, you know, like a lot of organisations, if the physical event can't go ahead, could they try and replicate what happens at the Chelsea Flower Show every year in a virtual event? So I had a chat this week or a couple of weeks ago with the society's Digitech team, who are like responsible for their web presence and everything, but it's IT team and also their hosting provider, which is a company called IOMART, to find out basically how within 8 weeks they went from the show being cancelled to trying to put on a virtual event and all the challenges that are around that. And like I say, as we were saying elsewhere on the podcast, some of the challenges they came up against in that will be ones that technology teams in lots of organisations are going through at the minute. So the show itself has always had kind of an online component to it, but it's always been kind of complementary. It's not been like, you know, the star of the show or anything. So they basically had to do something they'd never done before, which is put on a 5-day virtual show. You know, they're all working remotely, so they're having to work on this and brainstorm it they're saying, you know, no whiteboarding or anything like that could happen. It had to be like, right, okay, how do we achieve this? At the same time, they were telling me that the society itself had had to furlough some of their staff. So they're trying to deliver something that is brand new. They've got, you know, maybe a reduced manpower in certain areas.
Yeah, people, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just, you know, lots to do at once. And but what was quite interesting that came out of the chat was that, well, obviously, given the time scale they were working under, one of the things they said almost straight away was that we have to just deliver this with the technology we've already got. You know, there's, on the one hand, there's not really time to go out and source anything new. But, you know, first and foremost, the show is about the flowers and the plants and the gardeners and the people who are sort of pulling all this together. It's not about the technology. So the technology just has to provide, like, you know, host the show, but it's not, you know, we don't need anything sort of bells and whistles. It's just got to host the content. So yeah, so it was a really interesting chat, like I say, hearing from a tech team who are, have had to respond to things right in the middle of coronavirus, brand new challenges. It, going into the call, I was just like, okay, so you know, you must have had to throw a lot of technology at this. And it's just like, nope. It's just everything we already do. What we've had to do is just make sure our existing infrastructure could cope with a completely unknown number of visitors to the website. We just had to make sure the website could stay up and the content, the virtual content for the show could be accessed. But, you know, there's no new technologies. They described it themselves as very much crystal ball gazing, because the traffic that's going to the society's website at the moment is already much higher than normal, because so many people are getting into gardening, so it's at the same level at the moment that it usually is when the Chelsea Flower Show goes ahead. So they were kind of like, well, if we suddenly say the show's online and all these people are interested in gardening now who weren't before, suddenly think, okay, I want to get involved, like, well, how do you even plan for like the kind of traffic we're going to see? So they had to, well, they just testing rigorously all the infrastructure, and I think they got to a point where they planned that they could have up 30,000 concurrent users on the site at once, and they got nowhere near that during the show, but they said they just had to over provision because, you know, it's the flagship show. If people can't get access to it, it's all been for nothing. So but spoiler alert, the virtual show went ahead, was a big hit, and they were sort of saying, you know, based on the success they had with the virtual show, next year they're going to be incorporating more elements of that into the physical programming. But it's a huge challenge as well, trying to make a replacement show for an event that is so sensory. You know, it's all about walking around, touching the flowers, smelling them and things like that. So they sort of said, oh, it's one thing we couldn't do, we knew from the start, was just try and, right, we're going to replace that or try and replicate that online, because it was impossible. So they said that they did more kind of they refocused the programming compared to normal. So usually it's all about say the plants and the gardens, their center stage, and that was still very much the case this year, but they brought in more of the sort of backgrounds and stories of the people who've created them to kind of make more of an emotional pull to the content and stuff like that. So it's trying to tweak all that, and that's what they're saying next year they can do more of as well. It did get me thinking, if you just think of all the virtual events we're doing this year, and you think, you know, next year will a lot of the tech conferences that, you know, have moved online, will they just go, you know, their event organizers sort of just, you know, chomping at the bit to think, right, I just want to get back to, I just want to get back to what we used to do. Or will they take a similar approach and, okay, well, that was really successful doing that bit virtually, next year, should we not do that in person at the event and have it as an add-on for online people? You don't know, but I think it could be, like we said earlier, none of us really knows what's going to happen next, but it's an interesting thing to hear them talk about what they've learned from the experience and how it enhanced what they do next for society. So you don't know, next year, you know, it could contribute to making the in-person show even bigger, or demand for tickets will be even higher. So there's positives to that. But like I say, it's just a really interesting chat to talk to people who are sort of trying to respond to this stuff almost sort of in real time as it's playing out. And it was interesting to me because, like I say, I'm a gardener now. Well, I think I can call myself a gardener. Hearing about all of that was, it's good chat.
I think it has implications for IT conferences as well, in that the conferences I've been to, I'm sure if you'll agree with this, Brian, the conferences that you've attended online, they've been quite focused because you can't really stay tuned into something for 8 hours, which you would normally have to do if you have been flown over to Vegas or somewhere.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to stay tuned in for that long. And in 1 hour or 40 minutes or however long, you have to, you know, you've got people, you have to present your message. And I think there's a huge opportunity for the IT industry itself to really get their sort of education kind of stream virtualized, totally virtualized, done through video conferencing. So that when people do eventually go to physical events, whether they're small events with maybe a few people, like meetups or these large global conferences, people are much more focused, they much more understand what the message is, and they'll get much more out of the events because they've been attending the virtual events throughout the year.
Well, I'm going to a virtual event next week, so see how it stacks up. That's SAP's annual event, Sapphire. That's going to be next week. The keynote's on Monday. Christian Klein, it's his first keynote as CEO of SAP, and I've got some user interviews lined up as well. I mean, it simply won't be the same because Sapphire is a very, I know we all attend very similar events to this where it's just really full on, 2, 3, 4 days, interview after interview. Mm. It's not going to be, well, thankfully, in a way, it's not going to be like that. But those are quite good learning occasions, those conferences. They are very intense. They are very full on. So we'll see how this virtual one goes next week. I don't know how innovative they're going to be, but we shall see. Are either of you attending anything
next
while?
Yeah, I've got the AWS summit next week, which is online only. This usually it takes place at Excel, but still trying to work through the agenda on that at the moment. It is a funny one because it's quite easy for your attention when you're sat at home to get pulled off elsewhere or for you to jump into emails, whereas when you're sat in a conference room with the spectacle of everything going on the stage, it kind of you're pulled in for a lot longer. So
similar in a way to being at the theatre. Because when you're in a theatre watching a 3-hour play, you're in your seat, and getting out of your seat to disturbing everyone else isn't really an option. So you are just kind of in a way stuck there to kind of absorb what's in front of you, and it's just not, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to replicate theatre on screen. I mean, I know there's been a lot of attempts to do it. And I've watched a few plays on my laptop and stuff, but you know, it just seems easier to watch some television instead. You know, something that's been made for a screen. So I think there's a 3-hour keynote and sitting in front of your laptop.
I just have lots of snaps.
And go back and stuff. But yourself, Cliff, have you got anything in the diary?
On the 22nd, I think it's next week, no, week after, possibly, HPE Discover is on. It's a sort of annual HPE event.
I think that's all we've got time for this week, sadly. It just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to our guest, Cliff.
Thank you for having me.
Not talking about an anniversary this time. And thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much to you, listener, for listening. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.